Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Hello and welcome to Canter. Today is myself, Adam Breeze, here to talk about the New Zealand referendum. Join with me today, we have Nandor Tanzost. How you going, mate?
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me on. Hey, everyone. So, yeah, my name is Nandor Tanzost. I'm an activist for the Make It Legal campaign. We're pushing for a yes vote in our referendum, which the final voting is on this coming Saturday. I've been involved in cannabis law reform for a long time. Since 1990, I've been involved with the Normal organisation, and then I was elected as a Member of Parliament for the Green Party here in 1999 and was there for about 8 years. Most of that time I was the drug policy spokesperson for the Greens, and again pushing for cannabis law reform. But I think what's interesting with this referendum is we're actually looking at fully legalising cannabis and regulating the market, and that's quite a lot further than kind of we felt able to go in the past in terms of people's understanding of the issue. So, definitely hoping for a yes vote on Saturday, or, you know, when we get the results back in.
Yeah, that's a great intro. So I just wanted to discuss, what drew you towards cannabis?
What drew me to cannabis? Well, when I was young, lots of people were using it. It's pretty standard young experience to at least try it. Here in New Zealand, I don't know about in Australia, but the figures here are saying that 80% of people would have tried it by the age of 25, which clearly shows that prohibition isn't stopping people trying it. A lot of those people don't continue to use it for various reasons. Some people don't like it, you know. But the law itself doesn't seem to deter anyone. I don't drink alcohol. I gave up alcohol, decades ago. It was the kind of thing that I found very easy to misuse. It made me stupid, like I suppose a lot of people. I don't get aggressive on it, but a lot of people do. I found cannabis was a preferable thing for me. But then also, as a Rastafarian, it's also a sacred herb. And so that has another angle on it. But I would say that the use of cannabis is really different from the support for reform. Like in our Make It Legal campaign, we have a number of people who don't use cannabis at all, and never have, in fact, because the issue is not really about whether we like cannabis. The issue is about what's the best way to deal with it, but recognising that lots of people do use it. Lots of people are made criminals for using it. Lots of people lose all kinds of life opportunities if they get caught using it. And so, you know, is there a better way of dealing with it? And clearly there is, because prohibition is a complete failure on by any measure, you know. So.
I definitely agree. I'm sure a lot of people agree that putting people in jail for their own personal use is just completely wrong. And going into the referendum, we should totally just go over what rules are proposed and what change we, if it goes through, we are going to see.
So, I'll just touch on what we're voting on. But just to say one thing quickly, which is that there's been widespread support for decriminalisation for a long time in this country, majority support, according to the poll. A couple of years ago now, the Parliament passed some legislation to really explicitly make it clear to the police that they don't need to prosecute for cannabis. And in fact, there was a preference towards avoiding the criminal justice system and leading people into more of a treatment kind of approach. So a lot of people here are saying, oh, we don't need to change the law because it's already been effectively decriminalised. And that's not actually true. We still have thousands of people a year whose most serious offence is a personal cannabis conviction. And we have a number of people in prison even for personal use, which seems really bizarre. But of course, what's happened is that the people who are still being prosecuted are almost entirely young Māori men. So the police are turning a blind eye or taking a very kind of lenient approach for many people, but because there's a systemic racism through the criminal justice system that's enacting in the cannabis response as well. And so young Māori men are still being prosecuted. And that's one of the most, that's one of the worst things about it, is that a lot of people go, oh, I don't care because it doesn't affect me, because they're not from the demographic that gets busted. And I just don't see how as a country we can allow that to continue. But just coming to your point about what's actually being proposed, so it's quite a bold move actually for the government to have a referendum on actual legalisation. So it's called the Cannabis Legalisation and Control Bill. And so first of all, it says that adults can use cannabis, can possess cannabis, can grow cannabis for themselves if they're over 20. So I put in an R20 age. It says if you're an adult, you can grow two plants for personal use. And in a household where there's more than one adult, no more than four plants in a household. And one of the things that we need to clarify is when they say two plants, what does that mean? Are we talking about two adult plants after they've, become obvious switch to the males and females and these kinds of things, or are we talking about two seedlings? And I think the intention is for two adult plants, but I think the law needs to clarify that a little bit. So you can grow a couple of plants for yourself. You can carry up to 14 grams in public. There's no limits on what you can store in your own home from your harvest, because some people can grow quite a lot with a couple of plants, if they're especially outdoor organic or indoors on a regular cycle, turning over two plants at a time, you can generate a reasonable amount. So there's no limit on what you can store. And you're allowed to share socially. So the law recognises that we're generous. Humans are generous. We're social, we're generous. That's our actual intrinsic nature, and we like to share with our friends. So the law kind of recognises that that's okay. And then it goes, okay, what about the sale? And so it sets up a licensing scheme where people will be licensed to grow cannabis, licensed to sell it. And again, you've got to be 20 to buy it. You can buy up to 14 grams at one time. And a lot's been made of this, 14 grams, that's like 14 grams a day, that's a lot of cannabis. But of course, people don't buy daily. There's no limits on how much alcohol you can buy. You can buy as much as you like. And if you buy, if you buy a bottle of whiskey, most people don't expect to finish that in a night. It might last them, who knows. So cannabis is the same. It's a maximum daily amount, but recognizing people buy for a week or month or year or whatever's defined. So, so it's a limit how much you can buy. And then there's some interesting restrictions around the sale. So in the United States, there's quite a commercialized model. And in this country, people are very concerned about kind of big cannabis taking over, big multinationals coming in. And so the other thing is that because one of the intentions of the law is to get rid of the black market, recognising we probably won't get rid of it entirely for a long time, but we will put a dent in it. If we want to minimise the black market, one of the things that we have to do is make sure that people who are currently illegal growers have a pathway to become legitimate business people, pay their taxes and obey the rules. So they've made it really clear that having a cannabis conviction won't stop you getting a license, which I think is really good. They've set up things so that no one organisation can control more than 20% of the market. So this to keep it diversified. If you think again about alcohol here, 80% of the market is controlled by two companies. And so it's trying to avoid that big domination by a few large companies, which also then have an economic power for lobbying for more relaxed rules and stuff. They're trying to avoid that. And then they've also set aside a proportion of licenses is for what they call micro cultivators, and so very small scale growers. Because there's a lot of misinformation about growers, and large scale operations which are pretty heavy. But a lot of growers are actually just ordinary people who grow a few plants for themselves and flick on a little bit. And what they flick on, especially in some of our poorer communities, it's really just, it's the money that gets the car fixed or gets the driveway potholes fixed up, or, you know, just some real basic stuff. And often people who are, as I say, in poor communities where there's not a lot of economic opportunity, you know. So it's kind of recognizing that some people are quite small, and so micro cultivator licenses allows those people to come in and get a piece of it as well. So I really like that kind of approach. And then they've also said when it comes to the retail side that there's a priority would be given for non-profit organisations who partner with poor communities, with Māori communities. So again, they're trying to create a model where the business isn't just being gobbled up by big USA investors, but it's local. So we're not going to allow importation of cannabis, for example. So it's about generating a New Zealand cannabis industry, which I think is great, you know. So the rules are probably, there's in places where they're a little bit more restrictive than I would like. For example, they've put on the cannabis for sale, not on what you grow, but on the cannabis for sale, it can't be stronger than 15% THC, which I think is unnecessary and not very, I don't see the point. But having said that, there's a lot of people kind of going, oh, this means they'll just be sitting bushweed, you know. There's nothing wrong with bushweed, actually, but, you know, they'll be selling, like, low quality. And I don't think that's true. People, of course, because cannabis is illegal, no one gets their cannabis tested. So we don't know really very accurately what's currently for sale. And I suspect most New Zealanders wouldn't get regular access to anything over 15% anyway. Some of the seed companies would say, oh, this stuff can produce 20, 25% or whatever. But, you know, in reality, that's under perfect growing conditions, perfect harvesting, optimal curing. And, you know, someone who's completely on top of the game, I would have thought 15% for most people would be entirely adequate. And in fact, the research from Canada is showing that while the producers are pushing towards stronger and stronger herb and, you know, dabs and all this kind of stuff, actually the consumers largely don't want that. People don't want to get shit-faced. Most people want to have some herb and mellow out and have a good time and still be conscious, you know. So this kind of drive towards stronger and stronger cannabis, actually, as I say, I don't think it's what most people want in any case.
Yeah, and with the THC numbers, people always just look at THC, but they're not looking at different factors that contribute to the high, basically. You know, you have the terpenes and all that that's going to contribute. So if you're having a strong strain, like you said, most people, like the general public, doesn't want to get knocked out every night. And this leads me on, you said there that no cannabis is going to be imported into New Zealand.
Not legally.
I just want to talk about the benefit to the New Zealand economy, legalising cannabis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a really interesting question. And, of course, it's always difficult to know for sure because it is currently illegal. So how do you really get a real sense of the size? And people have tried and they've used a few different approaches, but I don't know that any of them are particularly helpful. Probably the most accurate figures we've got on use rate is how much people use this from these. There's a couple of longitudinal studies done at Otago University where they've followed thousands of New Zealanders over decades now, and they've developed a kind of rapport with the participants so that they actually get quite accurate information. But even then, it's a bit hard to know exactly how much people are using. So there's probably been three or four economic analyses done really since kind of around this referendum. And it's mostly been looking at the tax take because what I think the government has intended is to try and keep the cost of cannabis about what it is now. They don't want it to become a lot cheaper because they don't want more people using it. You know, that's the government's objective. But they don't want to make it too expensive because then the currently illegal market undercuts the legal market and they don't want that to happen. And recognising that growing it legally will probably cost quite a bit less for a whole bunch of different reasons. So they're going to set the tax to try and keep the price out now. And the estimates are around that the tax take will be, the estimates range from about $150 million to about $1 billion. I think a billion is exaggerated, but I think we will be looking at in the hundreds of millions of tax take. That's not counting the GST, that takes the top, I think. In terms of the kind of economic benefits, because then the other thing is, it's not just the tax revenue, but what are the cost savings for the government? And that's in the hundreds of millions. And there's a whole lot of unquantifiable things. Like, for example, if people aren't getting criminalized for cannabis use anymore and therefore not losing jobs, which happens to people, not losing potentially housing, not losing educational opportunities, what are the economic benefits of that? It's very hard to say. So, I think it's clearly looking in the in a broader economic benefit, it's looking in the high hundreds of millions, I would say. But, as I say, different studies show different things. So we know it's a lot. We know it's substantial. And we know that there's a lot of places. And again, I think this gearing the licensing towards kind of poorer communities, I think, is really helpful. So where I live in a small town in the eastern Bay of Plenty called Whakapane. We've got, I think, 30,000 people in our district. And we've got some of the poorest communities in the country in this area where people do grow now as a way of surviving. And if we can make sure that licenses are going out to some of those poor communities, it's not just the kind of purely quantifiable economic benefits, but the what that does for those communities who've had no opportunity now for decades since the forestry was closed down when they privatised it all. Those communities have had no opportunity for a long time, and it's kind of giving them a way out. And I think the spin-offs from that is not just economic, but the social cultural benefits of that are just enormous. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people want this referendum and they want change all for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And then you have the people that don't want change and, you know, they have their reasons. I just want to cover some of the, well, myths and misconceptions that they're talking about. And the biggest one I've seen is all kids will get access to cannabis now once it's legalized, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd just like you to talk about restriction and children when it comes to cannabis.
Mm, yeah. Look, and there's a lot of misinformation and I think deliberate misinformation. We've got a lot of resourcing coming out of the evangelical churches in the state supporting their branches here to run the No campaign, Say No to Dope campaign. And it's both in terms of finances, but also possibly more importantly, the kind of grunt they bring in terms of campaign skills and how to run these kind of dirty campaigns, which they've been doing. And there's, you know, like outright lies being spread by them. Think like saying, oh, this is what's going to happen. Things that the bill specifically prohibits. They're talking about, oh, you know, marketing for kids, which the bill specifically prohibits, that kind of stuff. So a lot of misinformation. And yes, this is, and for me, it's funny, eh? Because for me, one of the most powerful arguments for wider society is that we expect cannabis use by underage people to go down because that's what's happened everywhere that it's been legalized. You know, and the reason why we want that, of course, is because, you know, most people who use cannabis do so without any problems at all. The few people that do have problems, and some people do have real problems, they're almost entirely people who started very young and use heavily into adulthood. So not everyone who starts young is going to have problems, but the people who do have problems are among the ones who started young. So if we can delay people using cannabis, that's a good thing. You know, we have less problems, the social benefit. And in the cannabis law reform community, we've always said we expect underage use to go down if you introduce an age limit, because you don't have an age limit now. You rock down to the city house and no one's asking to see age ID. I mean, kids are rocking up there in uniform and buying tinnies, no problem, you know. So you expect kind of theoretically that underage use would reduce. But what we're seeing now is that's what's happening in practice. And Canada is quite compelling because the New Zealand's proposed law is quite heavily based on Canada with imp- improvement, because I think they made a number of mistakes over there, particularly around how they got their licensing underway. So I think we've learned from that. But essentially, the kind of model is largely based here. And in Canada, figures, the Statistics Canada has put out some really interesting figures showing that overall cannabis use has remained pretty much the same. For under 25s in general, it stayed the same. For over 25s, occasional use, so used in the last 3 months, has gone up a tiny bit, like a fraction. But for 15 to 17-year-olds, it's almost half. It's gone from, like, I think 19.8% to 10.4%, something like that. So it's almost half among that 15 to 17-year-olds. And to me, that's enormously powerful, because if you can reduce use at that age, that's a good thing, you know. And the only group for whom regular use has gone up, this is daily or almost daily, is among the over 65. And, to summarise that, overall use remains the same. Underage use goes down significantly, and then over 65 goes up again a little bit. And there's a lot of kind of speculation about why that is. And I suppose there's a lot of people who, older people who don't try it as a medicine, although they've heard good things about it, they don't try it because it's against the law. They're probably the only group that the law actually inhibits from using it. And so they are willing to try it. But it may not all be medicinal. Maybe, you know, when I'm 65, I'm going to be like, why the hell shouldn't I have a joint? You know, who's going to tell your granny she shouldn't have a cookie? You know, but the thing about underage use, it goes down, and there's clear reasons why that is. And you just got to look at how we treat alcohol and how we treat tobacco. And again, I don't know in Australia, but in this country, tobacco use and alcohol use have been trending down over a number of decades. And it's because we've put in place age limits and we regulate it. And we've done a whole lot of stuff around it and pricing and things like that. But we don't ban it, because we know that when we banned it, alcohol in the United States in the 50s, we got moonshine, we got alcohol poisoning, we got Al Capone, and all those problems with prohibition, which is exactly what we see in the cannabis market.
Yeah, banning a substance definitely isn't the way to get rid of it. And like you said, with children, basically regulating and restricting it, you know, right now, there's no age limit. You don't know where the stuff is coming from. And children have no control. You know, once they fall into it, you know, they can fall into a bad friend group. They don't see any negatives. You know, why should they stop? You know, so with all this restriction, you know, it's not going to be hugely restricted, but, you know, basically getting good product, keeping it away from our children as much as we can is the right move forward, you know, instead of what we have now. I think this has been really, really... Continue.
Can I just say one thing? Because you touched on a couple of things there, which I think are really important as well. So we've got the kind of reducing underage use, which is a huge benefit. And then there's two other things I think which is important is for adults, having a licensed place to go, it means that they've got a safe, reliable place. They know exactly what they're buying. There's good product information. They can choose different strains. They can choose strengths. And it's completely transparent. And at the same time, if you're worried about health, you can provide health information at the point of sale as well. So, you know, there's enormous benefits for people just from that kind of having a safe, reliable supply. And when I said before about we won't get rid of the illegal market entirely, again, from overseas, the market's gone down 20, 30% or so, it seems, in different jurisdictions. And what I'd expect to see is those tinny house kind of operations which are unsafe, pretty dodgy kind of operations, they're the ones who will disappear, because why would you go to a tiny house when you can go to a licensed shop? And the ones I think will stay is where you've got people who supply high quality products to a small group of people that they know, they have a good relationship, they're reliable, and those kind of relationships I think will probably continue for quite a while. But the other thing I was going to say about the regulation is the other thing I think is a huge benefit is that what you avoid is the upselling to other drugs. So in this country, we have a really significant and growing problem around synthetics and also around methamphetamine. And increasingly, I'm hearing stories about people who are been, you know, they go to buy cannabis. They're being told we don't have cannabis. The methamphetamine is really rife in many parts of our community. And I think if by stopping the cannabis sellers upselling to other drugs, that's a huge social benefit as well. And again, if you look at like in Holland, which has been one of the forerunners, I mean, their policy has been legally, they've done things we couldn't do here, for example, because of the way they're set up. But, you know, if you look at their policy for a long time, an explicit point of it has been to separate the market for cannabis from the market for other drugs. And as a result, they've got one of the largest drug in Europe. And the population aging, which means that, you know, young people are coming in. So separating hard drugs and good products information, I think, are really important benefits of a regulated market.
Yeah, and, you know, something you said that really stood out. People were looking at it from the view that cannabis is illegal and it's a drug, so it's in the same category as all these other drugs, you know, and I think that's where some of these myths and misconceptions would have come from. Also, people looking at it as in cannabis isn't here already. You know, they kind of look at it as from the view that, you know, it's going to be flooded when it's already not.
Yeah.
It's just not the case. It's just about regulation, making sure people safe. Like you said, people have a safe place to, you know, consume. And, you know, I think that's really, really important for people to understand. I think this has been a really, really good chat.
It's all these behaviours, which are kind of personal, they're personal decisions, victimless crime. You know, we can either take the approach of we just say no and that's it, or we recognise the reality. You know, people are worried about cannabis being normalised. Cannabis is entirely normalised in this country. You know, you talk to any room of young people and who can get access to cannabis, and the whole room will put their hand up. Usually it's harder for them to get hold of cannabis than it is to get hold of alcohol. I mean, sorry, easier to get hold of cannabis than it is to get hold of alcohol. You know, so it's entirely normalised. So this idea that somehow we're normalising something which is already right in our community is absolutely ridiculous. So then you either go, oh, we'll just say no. It's like sex. Or we'll just say no. Or do we teach sex education, you know? Just say no, or do we actually regulate and make sure that people can make their decisions with good information, with honest information, and in a way that's safe? You know, it's
the frustration is real against these people. So Make It Legal NZ is the page that brought me to you, and I'd like to give a huge shout out to them. They're pushing, you know, trying to spread awareness of the referendum and voting yes. And guys, it's really, really important. Voting ends this weekend, so make sure you get out and vote, please. Nando, it's been.
And can I say, because there's a lot of New Zealanders in Australia, and if any of you are listening, this is going to be every vote. We are on a knife edge. The polls are showing it is so tight, no one can call this. I'm confident, but no one can call this. Every single vote is going to count. I think it wouldn't be surprised if we get a recount and we could win or lose by literally 5 votes. So if you're a New Zealander or you're eligible to vote in New Zealand and you haven't voted already or you're not enrolled, do so now. Go to vote.nz. It'll tell you how to enroll if you're not enrolled. It'll tell you how to vote. Your vote is absolutely critical. So please, we need you. And thank you for your time, Adam. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, the power is in your hands, people, so make use of it. It was great talking to you, mate. Catch you later.
Same, bro. See ya.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantor. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Cantor strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.